following audio is from The Exchange Church. More information is available at theexchangemi.com.
For those of you who are staying in here, we will be in Mark chapter 5. Mark chapter 5, if you are using one of the Bibles in the backs of the chairs here, is on page 840. And we will be looking this morning at the encounter between Jesus and the demon that was actually a host of demons, and he gave himself the name Legion because of the number of demons. And so what we'll do is I will read this, we'll do some brief introduction, and then we'll walk through the passage. So Mark chapter 5, starting in verse 1, we'll read through verse 20. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For Jesus was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him, saying, "Send us into the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs. And the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. The herdsmen fled and told in the city and in the country, and people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs, and they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed by the demons begged him that he might be with him. And he did not permit him, but said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And everyone marveled. Father, as we walk through this passage today, I pray that you would let us see your mercy, and that your mercy to us would be a transformative mercy, such that we would follow you with gladness. Amen. Well, we're in the middle of a sermon series entitled "Good News, Jesus Has Come. Will you follow him?" And this comes right out of the first chapter of Mark. Mark's very first words is that this is the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And that word gospel means good news. This is the good news about Jesus coming. And Jesus then goes and he preaches the gospel. And right after Jesus preaches the gospel, the first two words out of his mouth are, "Follow me," as he begins to call people to follow him. And so Mark is going to take these two themes of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the good news that Jesus has come, and the call to follow Jesus, and walk with these all the way through his gospel. This morning, as we come into chapter 5, we see the transforming power of Jesus in a particular way that Jesus calls this man to follow him. Here we can say that we see, and we'll give this as the title for today's sermon, that mercy creates missionaries. Mercy creates missionaries. Now, setting the scene here a little bit, this is in multiple ways, a shocking passage, because we know that Jesus is a Jew who came to the Jews who were the chosen people of God. And we oftentimes will remember the great commission that Jesus, when he ascended into heaven, he sent his disciples out and told them, including the apostle Paul, go to the Jews first and then to the Gentiles. But what is so shocking about this is that Jesus goes into the region of the Decapolis, and that maybe means absolutely nothing to you. So let me just summarize that Jesus leaves on the one side of the Sea of Galilee, and he crosses the Sea of Galilee to go to the region of the Gentiles. And he goes into the region of the Gentiles, and commentator James Edwards summarizes it this way, that Jesus meets a man with an unclean spirit, living among unclean tombs, surrounded by people employed in unclean occupations, all in unclean Gentile territory. And he goes there, and what you see at the end of this passage is the very first person that Jesus commissions to go share the gospel is a Gentile. That is shocking in biblical history. As you're reading through, and what you see here is that all of a sudden Jesus takes and he crosses the great divide, the great ethnic divide between Jew and Gentile by saving and commissioning this man first. If you remember, who is Mark writing to? He's writing to the Gentiles, probably in Rome, reminding them of the great mercy that God has had upon them, that even one of them was the first to be commissioned. Well, as we come here, we meet this man. And when we meet him, we find him possessed by a legion of demons. We're going to break this down. You can entitle them 3 points, but we're going to break this down into looking at it from 3 different ways. The first is the call as Jesus comes to this man. So we can say that Jesus calls the despairing, the fearful, and the self-destructive. Jesus calls the despairing, the fearful, and the self-destructive. We see this here in the passage. The demon-possessed man lived in the darkness of death. Where was he? He was wandering day and night in the tombs. He was terrorized. What do we find him doing? He's crying out. And he is self-destructive, cutting himself. We see that in verse 3, that he lived among the tombs. In verse 4, he could break the shackles. No one could subdue him. And in verse 5, we see the breakdown of the 3, night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, crying out and cutting himself with stones. But I want you to notice something here. The order is a little out of order in the text, and so it's difficult to see what precisely happens here. But if you look, you see that Jesus, in verse 2, he stepped out of the boat, and immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with the unclean spirit. But then look at verse 6. When he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. Now, typically when this passage has been presented to me, I get this image of Jesus sort of getting off the boat. Maybe he's chatting with his disciples. He's kind of looking around at the countryside. And then all of a sudden, this crazy, wild, naked man comes running down the hill, crazy at Jesus. And then Jesus begins to address him. But that's not what happens. If you look in the text at verse 8, you see that when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran down and fell before him and said these things to Jesus. We see why he did it. For he, Jesus, was saying to him, come out of the man, you unclean spirit. And so I want to set the stage just a little bit so you can see what's actually taking place in the narrative is that the boat is coming up to the shore. You have a group of herdsmen and an entire flock of pigs over here, 2,000 pigs, stinking it up. And Jesus sees this man and begins to yell at this man, speaking to the demons, come out of the man, you unclean spirit. It is not the man and the demons that are taking the initiative here. It's based on Jesus' action. Jesus comes up here. He's not talking to his disciples. He's not going, well, let's talk to these herdsmen and share the gospel with him. He's looking at the man who is despairing, fearful, and self-destructive, and he says, you are going to be mine. Jesus calls the despairing, the fearful, and the self-destructive. And I want to take just a moment to look here in verse 5 to see the three-part description of this man again. Night and day among the tombs. This past week, we talked some about fear, and we talked about fear and its tie to death. That death is what gives teeth to all of our fears. And where does the demon take him? Where does the demon force this man to be day and night, face to face with death? Face to face with death. This past week, sitting in my living room, it could not have been said better than when a young man looked up at me and said, "My greatest fear is death." He got right to the heart of the issue that everyone faces, and precisely where this man was, tormented by this demon, looking in the tombs, being reminded the day is coming when there you lie. Despairing and fearful. You see his response, his first response that's mentioned here, in response to the presence of death, always he is crying out. The word that is used here in the Greek is not crying out with words, but crying out with terror, perpetual terror, screaming and crying, because it is a man, and it is a man oppressed by demons. He is tortured and tormented, and all that is left for him is to scream in terror over the power of Satan at work in his life. It is striking to me, the longer that I am in ministry, and God has given me the opportunity to be in many and varied situations, sitting with people, talking with people, listening to people talk about some of their great struggles in life, and the number of times that someone has sat across from me and for the first time shared something with me that I've never even thought of before. And I will think to myself, I don't know where the scriptures talk about that. And I specifically remember very early on in ministry, a young woman sitting with me and another pastor and her husband in an office beginning to talk about self-harm. And many of you may know, or you may have struggled or do struggle with self-harm. And I remember sitting there as a young man in that office and thinking, oh man, seminary classes, I haven't talked about this one yet. I don't know what to do. And yet, here we find, what is this man doing? He has taken the sharp stones and he has begun to cut himself. Why? Because he is deep in fear and despairing in the face of death. And Jesus doesn't look at the herdsman. He looks right at him from out on the boat and says, "You, I'm going to transform your life." To put it in Ray Ortland's words, there is no temperament that Jesus cannot control. There is no madness that he cannot soothe. There is no darkness that he cannot illuminate. There is no raving that he cannot calm. There is no shame that he cannot dignify. There is no nakedness that he cannot clothe. There is no legion that he cannot command. That is who Jesus is. And Jesus comes to the man who is bound up by Satan in self-harm, terrorized and despairing, to deliver him. But I want to consider for a moment and remember why Jesus could ultimately do this. Jesus is the one that when he went to the cross, we use a word, it's called substitution. We will often talk about the atonement, that Jesus paid the price for our sins, and that is true, but he did it through substitution, by putting himself in our place. And I want you to think for just a moment about what it meant for Jesus to be on the cross. Jesus, when he went to the cross, went to the place of the great terror of death in Jerusalem, to the place of the skull. Jesus went face to face, not just with death, but with death in the most terrifying place. That's where Jesus went. This man is terrified in the tombs. Jesus went to the place of the skull. This man was crying out, and Jesus, when he hung on the cross just before he died, what does he do but cry out? Words had been uttered, but at the last he cries out. Jesus willingly submitted himself to cutting and lashes and piercing in great pain. I want us to see that as we look into this man's life, this tormented man's life, that for this man, substitution meant that Jesus would put himself precisely in this man's place so that he could say to this man, I understand your pain at the resurrection. That this is not merely Jesus showing mercy by delivering him, this is Jesus showing mercy through deliverance that would ultimately come by Jesus identifying with him. It is singularly the power of the gospel of Jesus Christ that delivers despairing, fearful, self-harming people. Now, this should not diminish that there are times and places where the diagnostic help of a doctor might bring some relief, but it will never bring the deliverance that the gospel of Jesus Christ brings. And we must remember that after Jesus ascended into heaven, he did not merely leave and somehow all of the work of Satan went away. No, what does Paul tell us in Ephesians chapter 6? When he tells the church to put on the whole armor of God, why does he say that we ought to put on the whole armor of God? That we may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. May there be some physiological issue tied to your struggle with depression and fear and self-harm? Absolutely. But at the root of that, what does Paul say? We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, neither others nor our own, but instead we wrestle against the rulers, the authorities, the cosmic powers over this present darkness, over the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. And brothers and sisters, we best never forget that. That the ultimate war will not be won by what we can see, but against what we cannot see through the gospel of Jesus Christ that we believe. This man experienced in this moment deliverance. When Jesus said, come out of the man, you unclean spirit. Hearing that his name is Legion, he then cast him out into pigs. This sets up begging. You begin with Jesus encountering this demon, and Jesus, through his transformative power exercised over this man's life, sets up a series of beggings. Yes, I said begging, like B-E-G-G-I-N-G. This brings us to our second understanding of this passage and what Mark is doing, that Jesus' transformative power that comes through the gospel of Jesus Christ, Jesus' transformative power forces a choice. Me or your pigs? I want you to note what happens here. The first begging begins in verse 10. And he, Legion, begged him, Jesus, earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. And they, the demons, begged him, Jesus, saying, send us to the pigs. Let us enter them. And so he gave them permission. And then what do we see happens? They enter the pigs, and the pigs run off and kill themselves, running into the sea. Why would Jesus do this? And we have to address something here. There are actually a a number of pastors and commentators that deal with this in one of two ways. They either say that this shows that Jesus was actually an immoral man because pigs are smart and good pets and Jesus killed them and that can't be right. And then there are others that say that because this is an immoral action on Jesus' part, that actually this never happened. We will not look at this in either of those ways, but begin by a perhaps secondary or tertiary observation of what Mark is communicating and what Jesus' actions communicate to us. That he is showing us the great chasm between the worth of one human life versus the life and lives of many animals. We find that God speaks to his people, particularly under the old covenant, telling them that they ought to care for their animals well. And we see that. This does not diminish that we ought to care for our animals well, but Jesus is saying one human life doesn't even compare. All of these pigs don't compare at all to the value of one human life, but that's not Mark's main point. Mark's main point shows up in verses 15 and 16 because Jesus is forcing a choice. He handles the expulsion of the demons to force a choice. And it's not a choice that's forced on the man, but it's a choice that's forced on the people. And we see here, we find the second begging. In verse 15, the people came to Jesus and they saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had the legion sitting there clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And it was right to be afraid. That no one, not even their strongest men, could subdue this guy. Not their strongest chains or shackles. And here he is. Someone more powerful than this man is in our midst. And they are afraid, rightly afraid. But then they hear the rest of the story in verse 16. Those who had seen it, the herdsmen, apparently show back up, described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs. I want you to notice that there is a shift that takes place. They see the demon-possessed man and they're afraid. But then they hear about the pigs, and what do? They began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. I'll let, because of how well he wrote it, in two short paragraphs, Ray Ortlund explain this again. And when Jesus proved his power, restoring this dear man who had suffered so much for so long, sending the demons into a nearby herd of pigs, the people, having seen and heard of Jesus' transformative power, began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. Jesus forced a choice on them, his transformation or their pigs. And they preferred their pigs. Sure, their world was dysfunctional with a man that kept them up with his screams at night and terrified their children during the day. But it was their world. It was their familiar world, and they preferred it undisturbed. I sat down in my office this week and I wrote down as I was studying, do I prefer Jesus or my pigs? And I would encourage you to ask the question, do you prefer Jesus or your pigs? Do you prefer the transformative power of Jesus or your prospering, comfortable pigs? I wrote down there in my office on my whiteboard meditations thinking through how do I get to the point of begging Jesus away? Well, it's always when I take things into my own hands, manipulating situations, trying to hold on to the things that I want, where I say, yeah, Jesus, I know what you might want right now, but would you please step aside for a moment so I can take care of this? You see, I don't think that we're so far away, or at least I can speak for myself. I am not so far away from the group of people that would look and say, but where are my pigs? I see your power, but where are my pigs? Will you follow Jesus if you lose what's comfortable? What if you were to lose your economic security? Would you still follow him? Will you follow Jesus if you were to lose that which was most precious to you on this earth? Would you still follow him? This is the point that Jesus is driving home, because it's not just about comfortability. It's about the fact that 2,000 pigs was a massive investment for somebody or a lot of somebodies. I don't know if it was owned by the herdsmen. I don't know if it was a co-op or owned by wealthy people, but it meant a lot of money and a lot of good bacon. And they wanted their bacon. They didn't want the transformative power of Jesus, and they begged him, please go. Do you beg him, please go? Or do you say, I will give up every pig if I can just have your power? In the text, we see a contrast made right here at the end between the people begging Jesus away and the man begging to be with Jesus. We see it there in verses 17 and 18. Mark puts them right together for us so that we can't miss the contrast. In verse 17, the people beg Jesus to depart. And in verse 18, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. What's the difference between the two? Well, the difference between the two is the powerful experience of Jesus' mercy. And so this can bring us to our final point. The life transformed by mercy longs for Jesus and follows Jesus. Longs for Jesus and follows Jesus. He longed to be with him. He begged him, and Jesus said no to him. He said to the man in verse 19, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done to you and how he has had mercy. The man knew the mercy of Jesus. And so what does he do in verse 20? He stops begging. He longed for Jesus, but when Jesus said, you've known my mercy, it turns him into a missionary. And he went away and he began to proclaim in the Decapolis, that means the 10 cities of the Gentiles, how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. This is one of the most shocking turns of Jesus' ministry. The man who he has just shown mercy to, who's been sitting at his feet, and if you follow the narrative and you look at this and you sit down and you look at a map and you see where they probably were and how far the herdsmen had to travel and how long, if they're running, it would have taken them to get there and to come back, you're looking at a few hours at least that this man could have sat down at Jesus' feet, and Jesus has delivered him from legion and has ministered to him for a few hours at least as he sits at Jesus' feet and he begs Jesus, let me be with you. And you would think, based on everything you've seen so far, the merciful Savior that has just done all of this incredible transforming in this man's life would say, get in the boat, let's go. And Jesus says, no. From verses 10 through 20, everyone is begging. The demons, the people, and the man. And Jesus listens to the demon. He does exactly what they want. He listens to the people and gets in the boat to leave. And the one person who wants to follow Jesus, he looks at him and he says, no. This historical account from two different angles, both with the pigs and with Jesus' response to the man, is forcing the question upon us, if you don't get what you want from Jesus, will you still follow him? And in the bigger story, our story that fits in with this story, isn't that just like God? He can say no in the moment because he knows the ending even when we can't see it. Jesus could say no to the guy in the moment because Jesus knows what's coming. He knows that ultimately he's going to say, yes, you can be with me forever. He knows that this guy's story on earth ends at the beginning of being with Jesus forever. And because the guy knows Jesus' mercy, he obeys his voice. Let me try to illustrate this with a poignant story from C.S. Lewis's, really just a part of the narrative, from C.S. Lewis's The Magician's Nephew toward the end. There's a young man who's named Diggory. And Diggory was at the beginning of the creation of Narnia. He got to hear Aslan's creation song. He saw everything growing and being created. And he watched this mysterious, powerful lion go past him. And Diggory starts to think back to our world, where his dying mother laid in a bed. And he works up the courage to go to the lion. And he says, "Please, Mr. Lion, Aslan, sir, will you give me some magic fruit of this country to make my mother well?" Up till then, the child had been looking at the lion's great front feet and the huge claws on them. Now, in his despair, he looked up at his face, and what he saw surprised him as much as anything in his whole life. For the tawny face was bent down near his own, and wonder of wonders, great shining tears stood in the lion's eyes. They were such big, bright tears compared with Diggory's own that for a moment he felt as if the lion must really be sorrier about his mother than he was himself.
My son," said Aslan, "I know. Grief is great. Only you and I know that yet. Let us be good to one another." And then Aslan says no. And he sends him, in fact, he sends Diggory. He says, "Diggory, you have to go on a journey and you have to go pick fruit." And when he gets to the fruit, what Diggory finds out is that he's picking the one fruit in all of Narnia that could heal his mother. But Aslan had forbidden him from taking it home. And Diggory is sad. All the way back to take the fruit back to the lion, he never spoke. The others who were with him were afraid of speaking to him. He was very sad, and he wasn't even sure all the time that he had done the right thing. But whenever he remembered the shining tears in Aslan's eyes, he became sure. In Aslan's tears, Diggory saw his mercy. And because he saw his mercy, Diggory followed the lion at great cost to himself. This man sitting at Jesus' feet, begging to go with him, is told no. But because he had seen his mercy and experienced his transformative, merciful power, when Jesus says no, the man gets up, he goes home, and he starts to proclaim the very mercy that he has experienced. And as far as I know, the guy doesn't know this, but can you imagine that moment when either near his death or in the moment when his eyes cracked open after he had breathed his last, and lo and behold, who was before him but the man whom he had begged, "Please let me be with you." And Jesus says, "You're with me now and forever." He gives him both what he needed and what he wanted at the right time, and the gospel is spread through the Decapolis. This man obediently goes and tells because he knows and trusts Jesus' mercy. And as I read this week, I struggled so much because it's so easy to want to be like the demons in this passage. To have God do what I want, when I want it, how I want it. To get irritated and mad at him when he doesn't do it. And the great wonder of even that temptation is that Jesus knows not only the temptation, but the times when I've sinned against him in that, and he went to the cross perfectly substituting in my place for that to transform me by his mercy. Because Jesus really does take despairing, terrorized, self-harming people like us and give us mission through his mercy. And then that mercy sustains us until we see him face to face. And all of our longings are met in him forever and forever.